if people can turn up to work as wholesome human beings and relate to each other in a wholesome, respectful, understanding way, that then we would create a team whereby, of course, we treat each other with the kindness and compassion that we would want for all human beings, and that through that trust and through that high regard, we will actually deliver our operational output to a higher degree. Influencing significant people across the hierarchy and enabling them, providing platforms for them to jump in and to lead by example is, I think, really important.
Yeah.
And leadership by example, or leadership through modelling one's own vulnerability and vulnerability in leadership, is really critical. Vulnerability in leadership and crying appropriately doesn't lose the faith and trust of your subordinates. It actually, more often than not, builds that faith and trust in who you are as a person, not just the rank that you have the honour to wear.
Rabbi Samuel Landau, Orthodox Jewish leader and clinical psychologist, is an unlikely candidate to lead culture and behaviour change in the Desert Rats. But that's exactly what he found himself doing after an unexpected invitation. Samuel is the founder of Someone Else's Eyes, which aims to help organisations thrive through building strong and healthy cultures. His work with soldiers shows how vulnerability, authenticity, honesty and trust can make hard-edged fighting forces more effective. And his powerful use of storytelling changes culture and behaviour to increase operational performance. Samuel and I both laughed and cried whilst recording this episode, and I'm delighted to share it with you. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Samuel.
I guess if you'd asked me 2 years, 3 years ago, if I would be sitting here talking to you about working with the army, I would have thought that would be a great April Fool's joke. I went on a leadership course at Windsor Castle that brought together leaders from across British society. It's under the Windsor Leadership Trust that I think was originally set up by the Duke of Edinburgh. And we had leaders from big business, charity, faith, military, police, and more, coming together for a week in the castle, almost like a leadership laboratory, which is a wonderful experience. And I was actually mostly wearing my rabbi hat and sort of loosely my clinical psychologist academic hat, and didn't quite know what to expect. I met a lieutenant colonel in the army who was going through his training prior to taking command, and we really hit it off, just as human beings. Mm-hmm. And so Ben and I started talking and talking and talking, and he was really concerned about the command that he was about to take because there had been some challenges in his infantry battalion, anything from at the very extreme sort of headline-worthy end, a neo-Nazi being put in jail who was a member of the battalion because he was stockpiling weapons to make attacks on Muslims and others, through to a soldier who lost his sight after an initiation prank into the sergeant's mess went wrong, all the way through to just being a place that didn't feel that nice to turn up to at work, that as a soldier or an officer you would dread arriving at camp on a Monday morning and you would be very happy to leave on a Friday afternoon. And that wasn't the sort of place that Ben wanted to lead. There was also a rich bloodline of Anglians through the army, so that can both be a blessing and a curse, that there is a lot of attention on the new commanding officer to turn the ship around. And so Ben threw a comment at me at the end of Windsor. I think I'll remember this moment forever. He turned to me and said, "Samuel, wouldn't it be great if you could come and meet my troops? You're a rabbi, you're a clinical psychologist, you're a third-generation Holocaust survivor. What a great experience that would be for my soldiers and officers." And perhaps with a little bit of Jewish chutzpah, I turned around to Ben and I said, "Ben, I think that's a horrible idea." And I explained that a meeting of that sort between groups of people that are very, very different, that come from very different backgrounds and walks of life, might just feel a bit odd. And not that enriching. But I said to Ben, "I think I could create for you a program, knowing what I do about moving communities as a rabbi and knowing what I do about moving groups of people as a clinical psychologist, where we take people on a journey, where we open people up to themselves, because I don't think you can ask a human being to be open to another human being unless they're already a bit more comfortable within their own skin. So let's start by that. Then let's be open to our group within the army. And then let's be open to the broad, diverse society that we're here to protect and serve. And then I think that meeting with the rabbi, clinical psychologist, third generation Holocaust survivor, that would be a great moment to have that time, to have that meeting.
I recognise much of that picture you described, particularly because I was in the infantry myself, and the absence of self-awareness, in fact, the determination not to reflect on ourselves, was ingrained in the kind of leader that one had to be, and that masking any vulnerability was critical in order not to portray a side of you that might be seen negatively. Was that what you found when you went to the battalion?
I think as a soldier, you've had operational experience. I have not had operational experience. The best I ever had was CCF, Combined Cadet Force, and therefore people laugh at me when I suggest that. I think as a soldier, you have to other the enemy. You have to make them an other, because otherwise you couldn't do what country and king now are asking you to do, which is to possibly kill that enemy, which is an act which takes away one's, or could take away one's humanity, which would require one to possibly dehumanize that target. So that mentality of othering people, of making them separate, is built into making me an effective soldier. The challenge is when we deploy that strategy and on a broad level without discretion, considering, do I need to other people in my platoon, other people in my company, other people in my battalion? Do I need to other my commanding officer? Do I need to other my subordinates? Do I need to other my family, my friends, because they're civilians? We can take a strategy which is very, very helpful within a particular context, and then that strategy becomes ossified and stuck, and it becomes a rule. And that rule then gets just indiscriminately deployed, and so now I'm othering everybody. And I think that tension between, or that requirement for flexibility between doing something when I'm in the field, or doing something when I'm on exercise, versus doing something or on tour, doing something when I'm at home, that navigation is tricky for all of us.
I remember as a young 20-something going for my operation for the first time in Northern Ireland, that was in the late 80s. We had a system of trying to manage that, which was called 0 to 60 and back again, because the environment was such that you would be effectively a civilian patrolling with a weapon in Northern Ireland. And suddenly, if you were shot at, you would have to then move into that 60 speed to then deal as a soldier with someone threatening your life. And then revert straight back into being a civilian with a weapon, because the complexities of the environment meant that you couldn't just stay in that dehumanized space. Mm. And I think that holds true even today, but it's more complicated than simply having a binary decision about othering or not. And the context and environment will change and dictate how you approach that. And is that what you found?
Yes. Life with complexity is much more challenging to navigate than life with simplistic rules. And speaking about diversity or difference and navigating those edges is always going to be more complex and complicated, and therefore require more thinking process and more persistent engagement than doing things as we've always done or as we always do. You're making me think about something with Ben's battalion. One of their great military victories was against the Sikh army, and that was part of colonial Britain deploying their strength across the colonies. And so they celebrate their victory over the Sikh army. And then here I am in 2023, and there's a Sikh colour sergeant, and there are other sergeants in the sergeant's mess who are caricaturing the Sikh army to demonstrate the might of the battalion against their enemies. But the colour sergeant and his family are feeling very, very uncomfortable in the audience watching that situation unfold. It requires a lot of complexity to really think about both the history that brought us to this moment of an infantry battalion that is proud of what it has achieved in the past and can now, in the current day, also welcome people that once were other and enemy. That's still a struggle.
And the challenge of not being constrained, as some people call tradition, being peer pressure from dead people, to generate an esprit de corps and a fighting spirit that's relevant for today and deals with the complexities of today and the future of conflict, where in many ways it's becoming even more complicated and relies on thoughtful approaches by everyone across the whole of the combat organization, not just the senior leadership. And has your program been focused across the levels of leadership?
Well, the first thing I was going to pick up on was tradition, because you're going to ask an Orthodox rabbi about tradition. I'm going to have to make some comment around both the helpfulness and at times unhelpfulness of tradition. Tradition gives you identity, and identity is really important. And in a world nowadays where identity can be so in flux, having pride, having a sense of self, having a sense of group, a sense of organization, a sense of mission, values and standards that bind us together, or a sense of morals and ethics that binds us together, that's a rare and important thing to have. And that is something that is very much present within the army and other public sector organizations, and shouldn't be pushed aside as something which is outdated and old. However, there are some of the trappings of tradition that could be updated to current modern society to enable that pride and that identity to be applicable in a whole, more wholesome way to today. I try to strive for a both-and approach to life rather than an either-or. In terms of the work that we did with the army itself, I think some people welcome this new way of looking at things. But change is hard wherever you're going to bring it. And because it's a culture change program, it is going to feel countercultural, which will be challenging. Maybe I'll lead with a Jewish joke, which is essentially a dad joke with a Yiddish accent. You're going to have to play along, okay?
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, so how many rabbis does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't know. How many rabbis does it take to change a light bulb?
Change? Thank you for laughing. It was very generous of you. Like any old ship that has been on a course for a very long time, with a whole set of not just beliefs, but also rituals and processes that surround what we do, there will be difficulties in bringing change. I'm never trying to please all the people all the time, because that is setting oneself up for failure and burnout. What I'm hoping to do is to mobilise a critical mass of people. And one of the ways that you can think about this is a bell curve. You've got about your 25% of early adopters. They're the people who've been waiting for this forever in the army. They're lapping up this program. I don't really care about them because they're already on the journey. You've got 25% of people. Some people label them as the dinosaurs, but they don't have to necessarily be so. It's not about their age. It's just about their way of doing things. This is not for them. They don't want to talk about what's under the surface. They don't want to engage with their emotional intelligence. They just want to be there, do their job, and keep that sort of alpha male stereotypical exterior. And I don't really care about them either, because I could expend a huge amount of energy trying to move them onto the journey and probably only move them one step. A lot of energy expended for small benefit. I'm really interested about the 50% in the middle that could go either way. They're uncertain. Mm. Maybe the old way of doing things and that tradition out of history, we should continue without any adaptation, because we've done well so far. Those rules, those unwritten rules of behaviour have helped up until this point in time. So let's just carry on doing that. Or maybe there could be a new way of doing things, not to ignore the richness of the past, but to also bring the organisation into a more helpful place for where they are currently. And it's those 50% of the people that, if we get them plus the 25% of the people already on the journey, you've got 75% of the organisation who are going into a new direction. That's how you bring about lasting change.
You talked about a ship earlier, and it reminds me of a quote which is from Seneca, who we were talking about Latin earlier, and he was Nero's tutor. In this quotation, he talks about every wind is an ill wind if you don't know which port you're sailing to. And therefore, in military terms, we talk about you've got to have a plan. When you develop the plan, the key stakeholders you've identified are that 75%. In a hierarchical organisation, that can skew which percentage has the power. In your other work, do you find that the hierarchical nature of organisations has an impact on the effectiveness of focusing on that bell curve?
there are always opinion makers within a unit. Often that's associated with your rank slide, but not necessarily. And there are some people that therefore you want to win because they will become champions of the work. And sometimes the word allies is used, but they become champions of the work who will then perpetuate that new way of doing things within the organization. One of the most beautiful examples of that was within, again, Ben's unit. We started off and I did not know how this was going to land, this new way of doing things, these sets of psychological workshops. And I was, to be fair, a little bit terrified coming into a organization which was very green and behind the wire. And I mentioned my CCF experience before, which on the one hand was very positive. I was in the Navy section. I went down to HMS Bristol, may it rest in peace, and had some fun time sailing around in the Channel, but also had some really negative experiences of being bullied, being on that boat and wanting to jump over the side. The remarkable thing about bullying is not that someone said a negative slur towards you. It's that somehow you start to believe it about yourself. And then it's the bullies of the mind that get under the surface. So I had this set of experiences which made me quite anxious going into that room. And here I was going, asking them to do something very different. And so one of the first sessions that we do is called the 12 questions. And you go around and answer questions that range from the serious to the absurd. Anything from things like, how old are you? Why did you join the army? Through to when was the last time you danced? To when was the last time you cried? Question six is when, approximately, is when the last time you cried. And a few people started joking. Oh, the last time I cried was when I watched EastEnders, or the last time I cried was when I was chopping an onion. And then we got to a sergeant major in the battalion, stereotypical sort of sergeant major, very big build, tattoos all over his arms. And he said, I was going to say the last time I cried was when I watched Marley and Me, which apparently is a real tearjerker. I haven't actually watched it yet, but that's a standard answer in the army for the last time I cried was Marley and Me. He said, but F it, I'm going to tell you the real truth. The truth is the last time I cried was on the 20th of December, which was the anniversary of my daughter's death. I cried last year. I'll cry this year. There you go. Mm-hmm. I effing said it.
Yeah.
And even in the conversation that we're having right now, you can feel that the tone has changed.
Yeah.
Almost like you can feel it in your gut.
Yeah.
And he jumped in, essentially. He lent into that moment of vulnerability, of trust, to share something that people in the battalion didn't know about him or his wife or their family story, but that he felt comfortable enough to share. And all of a sudden, people start sharing more. The last time I cried was when I was at my nan's funeral. The last time I cried was when I held my child for the first time. The last time I cried was when my mate, who had just left the army, killed themselves.
Mm.
Tears of sadness, tears of joy, but real tears nonetheless. And this sergeant major has become a champion for the work, for the culture change work, because he had a moment that changed him in that room that he shared with others and saw the ripple effects immediately. To the extent that he's gone and briefed the Minister for Defence and the Army Board and CGS around the work and has become a champion for the work. So influencing significant people across the hierarchy and enabling them, providing platforms for them to jump in and to lead by example is, I think, really important.
Yeah.
And leadership by example, or leadership through modelling one's own vulnerability and vulnerability in leadership, is really critical.
Mm. I remember when I was commanding my battalion, we had been sending a number of our platoons away to support other battalions and operations in Iraq. We had two of our soldiers were killed, and I had to form up the battalion on the parade square to break this tragic news. And I cried whilst telling them about it. And afterwards, I was accosted by a number of what I would describe as the more senior late entry officer community, and they chastised me for crying and for being emotional in telling this news. And the next day I was wandering around and met up with some of the younger soldiers, and they all to a person said, thank you so much for doing that, because it meant we felt able to express our emotions in a way that we historically didn't think we were allowed to. And I mean, I cry very readily, even at the most absurd things like Strictly Come Dancing. So I'm quick to tears. But I spent years forcing myself not to display that kind of emotion because I had a view about the kind of leader that one had to be. And that sense of being all inauthentic was, it wasn't a burden. I mean, I'm lucky in many ways, but it felt heavy. And it took me years to get to the point where I was in a position where I could be myself and not care. And I wish that others didn't have to wait that long to get to that position. And so it's really important the work you're doing enables people to have that kind of approach and to lean into those that are going to accelerate that that change, particularly in a hierarchical organisation.
I think we have two unhelpful beliefs about crying, for example, within the army and possibly even the police and other similar organisations as a leader. The first unhelpful belief is that if we cry, people will lose faith in our strength. And we privilege this idea of unflappable strength as something that must supersede my humanity or my authenticity or my modelling of vulnerability. And I think the other unhelpful belief is that if we do cry and then others cry, they will crumble. And there's a very British thing, which is if a person cries, what will you do immediately? You'll reach for a tissue, which on the one hand is a very well-meaning gesture. I can see that you're in distress and I want to help you mop up your tears. But covertly or implicitly is saying, please stop crying.
Yes.
Because we're worried that if you cry, then you're going to fall apart. And particularly if we know that that person has experienced trauma through their experiences on tour, or even just they're going through a difficult time at home with caring responsibilities or health or other things, we do worry that we have opened the floodgates and people won't be able to put the lid back on. One of the questions, back to the 12 questions that we have in workshop two, is what was your best day at work and what was your worst day at work? One of the private soldiers said their worst day at work was when they were grabbed for guard duty on Christmas Day. And that really was that private soldier's worst day at work. And I would not want to take that away from them. They had all these plans to be with family and friends on a special day. And then because of some change, they had to go and stand in the cold on guard duty. When we got to the majors in the room, one major said, my worst day was when I was carrying the stretcher of my dead sergeant major. And she cried. And the next major said, my worst day was when I watched the Taliban attack a maternity unit. And he described what he saw. And he cried. And there was a moment in the room. And I'm annoying because I'm a psychologist, so I ask questions. So I said to the private soldiers who were there in the room, I said, how do you feel about these majors sharing those tears with you? Do you respect them more or do you respect them less? And to a person, they said, we respect them more. And I said, would you work harder for that person because they've showed you their vulnerability? Would you work less hard for them? They said, we work harder for them. They're a real person. They're not just a crown on a rank slide. They're real people who had real experiences. I would work harder for them. And this sort of experience demonstrates that vulnerability in leadership and crying appropriately, because those were sad, sad events, doesn't lose the faith and trust of your subordinates. It actually, more often than not, builds that faith and trust in who you are as a person, not just the rank that you have the honour to wear.
You've talked for quite some time about two of your hats, your rabbi hat and your clinical psychologist hat. And I've seen you write that there's a paradox between the two. And I'm interested in exploring more about that paradox between the two and how you balance the approach and manage that paradox.
Those two hats aren't just two different roles, but they're also two different ways of looking at the world. So an example was, what is the target? What is my target for working with another human being, either as a rabbi or as a clinical psychologist? Because in a religious frame, my target is right and wrong. And in a psychological frame, my target is helpful versus unhelpful. And what might at the moment seem right for that person might actually still also feel unhelpful. That's one way of looking at it. Another way maybe to bring a story is the difference between judgment as opposed to understanding. As a psychologist, I'm there to understand. I'm not there to judge. I'm not there to provide any sort of moral compass as an imposition upon my patient. I'm there to understand why they're doing what they're doing or why they're feeling what they're feeling. A moment where my thinking got really clouded was when we had a forensic session where a convicted child abuser was brought into our training. I have a personal sensitivity, and I would go so far as saying a hatred of child abuse. That's from clinical experience, that's from other experiences where I feel an immense anger towards those who would use their position of power inappropriately to hurt children. And I knew that in terms of my moral compass, this was going to be a massively challenging session to hear the testimony of the gentleman that very generously came to speak of his experiences to a group of trainee psychologists. And he spoke, and he told us his story of being abused himself, of being deeply hurt, of learning that the way to show love to another was through sexual acts. And he built a relationship with children where he wanted to show his love to them, and this is the only way he knew how. And from the world of psychology, of understanding rather than judgment, one could really understand. And that understanding almost made me lose my own moral compass about what was right and wrong. Mm. Because you could understand everything.
Yep.
All acts can be understood. And if they can be understood, maybe that takes away some of their ethical challenge. And so I had to refresh myself and recognize that you can be both and, you can both understand and still say that is not consistent with my morality, with my ethics, with my belief system. And I guess bringing that back into the army frame, when you look at what people term as inappropriate behavior or bad behavior, when I go into the army, there's been so many people that have labeled certain behaviors as bad, they cease to wonder why the behavior is happening. And it's so easy to discount a person as just being a bad apple. Ugh. It's a bad apple, he's a bad person, or she's a bad person, that's why they did it, without wondering why. Mm. What would take a good person in a good organisation doing good things for the world, let's take those assumptions for the moment, to do something like that? Why have they done that? That is a new way of looking at things, I think, for the army in particular, for the public sector in general, particularly in policing, whereby we're not looking to condemn people's behaviour, we're trying to understand it. And if we can understand it, then we can look at those drivers, those underlying rules, such as the one we spoke about before. If I'm used to, as a soldier, othering people, if that's what I've been trained hard to do, and then I'm now thrust into an organisation where there are many others that I, because of my maybe British upbringing, have also been taught or programmed implicitly to consider as other, is it any wonder that without any other support around me, plus the stress that the organisation places upon me, that those cracks get exposed and I say something that is not really consistent with the way I want to be, but in that stress and with those underlying propensities for thinking in particular ways, that I would let out a racist or homophobic or misogynistic expletive or do something along that line. And if we can bring that understanding to their actions, then we can maybe change them.
Samuel, I've been working in diversity and inclusion and developing leaders for many, many years. But I have seen over the years substantial progress and tangible impact that's benefited operational effectiveness. There's abundance of evidence that proves the value of diversity and inclusion endeavours. However, there's been recent backlashes and claims that diversity efforts are largely ineffective. Is this what you have experienced in your work with someone else's eyes?
No, it's not. However, I understand some of the backlash. So the parody of a D&I initiative, a diversity inclusion initiative, that I remember when I was working in the NHS, was, for example, unconscious bias training, where I'd go into a room, and because I'm white, and because I'm a man, and because I'm married to a woman, instantly I would be told that therefore I'm homophobic, racist, and a misogynist. And I'd say, no, I'm not. That's not consistent with my values. Mm. And I wouldn't be able to hear any further the messages that were really important, which was about understanding the programming of the society that we live in, the assumptions that are there and gently under the surface, but influence how we think, behave, and act. And that, therefore, probably was an unhelpful experience for me and other participants if what we were trying to achieve was a greater openness, a greater curiosity, an awareness of the things that we don't know. So the intentions, the desire, I think most people could agree with. Maybe the execution is something that could be thought about differently. And what we've learned with our work with the army is that it wasn't either we are doing the right thing, we are making our teams more wholesome places for people of all differences, of all gender, of all sexuality, of all religion, of all race, of all class, of all culture, etc. Or we are now a hard-edged fighting force producing lethal output to win and fight wars on land. But actually, when we cohered a team and a unit and an organisation behind the overarching principles of, can we be vulnerable and genuine and authentic with each other? Can we build that deeper level of trust? Can we experience curiosity within that brave culture space and then bring a bit of flexibility to the way that we work? That didn't either do the right thing or bring about an operational advantage. It was both and. Mm. That the units that we work with both had a reduction in inappropriate behaviours, such as sexual assaults on camp or outside of camp, such as failures of compulsory drugs testing, or through to the softer side of behaviour, such as retention, all the way through to, and that unit then scored higher on their annual battlegroup exercise on Salisbury Plain, Wessex Storm. Their technical soldiering hadn't changed, but the external observers said that their teamwork and their culture had improved, lifting their lethal operational output. So all of a sudden, it was not either or. It was not either we do something which is in the pink, fluffy and woke space of diversity inclusion, or we do stuff in the hard-edged green of the military, but actually it's both and. And it's based around the very not innovative, not original idea that if people can turn up to work as wholesome human beings and relate to each other in a wholesome, respectful, understanding way, that then we would create a team whereby, of course, we treat each other with the kindness and compassion that we would want for all human beings, and that through that trust and through that high regard, we will actually deliver our operational output to a higher degree, which for the army, of course, is to win and fight wars on land and to fight for the interests of king and country.
As organisational and community leaders, with so much awfulness going on in the world, what approach do you think we can take to help minimise or reduce the division that seems to be happening all too quickly in our own world?
I have a dream podcast. I guess that's funny, being on your podcast. My dream podcast is to sit with two people that normally occupy opposite ends of a particular topic, whether that's around gender identity, around politics, or indeed around something such as the Israel-Gaza conflict. And what we normally see is people shouting at each other. My dream podcast is to sit with those two people and to learn about the shared humanity of those individuals. Let me learn about what motivates you. Let me learn about your hopes and dreams. Let me learn about the background that has led you to this moment, your family story, your crucible moments, those experiences that sort of made you and shaped you. And we do this a little bit within our workshops within the army, where we help people tell their personal stories to themselves and to each other. And what we learn when we do that storytelling is that there are vast differences of where we come from, but there are great alignments of who we are and what we want to achieve in life. And most people want to live, want to laugh, want to love, want to flourish, want to have financial security for themselves and their family, want to make some difference in this world, want to have a home that is theirs, that is their safe place. And then, once we've established the shared humanity of our two guests, let's say our imam and our rabbi, let's build a sense of why you believe what you believe and why I believe what I believe, and be able to hear each other. And you won't agree. You won't agree with everything. You will find certain things deeply disturbing. But you will also have a sense of that person as a human being who's trying to navigate the life that they've been given, the cards that they've been dealt. And that might give you a pause for thought and a pause to be more generous of spirit. And so I wish that we could, as leaders, community leaders, organisational leaders, model some of that ability to go into the space that angels fear to tread, the space where it's okay to sit with someone that is so different but is actually so similar in the fact that we're both human beings, as we said, journeying through life together. Yeah. That would be my wish.
I often go to quotations to find my eloquence, to overcome the absence of eloquence that I have. And just listening to what you've said then, there are a whole bunch of quotes in there that I think are enormously eloquent and powerful and relevant. But might I ask if you have, in spite of your abundant eloquence, a series of quotes or favourite quotes that you use that you find relevant and applicable and helpful for you?
A quote that I often think about is a quote from scripture. It actually features as part of our burial tradition. And we say at the time of burial, Ki imcha makor chayim in Hebrew, with you is the source of light. Ba'orcha nira or, in your light, we see light. That's a verse that teaches the reflected light from God into the world. And I adapt it slightly. And I say to another human being, in your light, you, a shining person in this world with a shining soul, with a unique contribution to make in your light, in the relationship that we can have where I see your light and maybe you see my light, we see light, because actually it's in that relational frame. It's where I sit with another person and seek out their light. I see my own light. And I guess in a reciprocal way, vice versa, that in the light that you see from me, that illuminates your world too. And so the company that I created is called Someone Else's Eyes, which is the light that we see by occupying another person's position, by being able to step outside of myself and see the world through your eyes, through someone else's eyes, and to see the light that they shine too.
My daughters will be whinging, not that they'll ever listen to this, but if they were to, they would say, oh, he's not going to say that, is he? And I am going to say it. It's a J.M. Barrie quote, which is, those that bring the sunshine to the lives of others cannot keep it from themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a relevant connection to your beautiful quotation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rabbi Samuel's honesty and commitment to understand shone through in our conversation. His determination to think deeply about unpalatable and difficult issues is so important if change is to happen. I'd love to know what resonated for you. Send me an email at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. And if there's someone you know who would benefit from listening to this episode, do share it with them. Take care until next time.